Geekscape.com.
National Socialism, a World Creed for the Future, by Colin Jordan. With the gigantic catastrophe of 1945, the greatest setback to human evolution in recorded history still close behind us, its chilling and choking memory still omnipresent, and before us, difficulties and disadvantages so gigantic as to deny us any immediate or early prospect of gaining power over our respective countries, what can be done? One option. It may be instantly stated with certainty we do not have in this doleful situation, and whereby it is vastly less doleful than otherwise, is of course to give up. This is something which a real National Socialist is by nature and by definition utterly incapable of doing, because the will to struggle, which is the elixir of National Socialism, is in the very bones of his being. Without it, he would not be who he is, but some spiritual eunuch of the living dead. A real National Socialist is one who, in the last resort, even if it could be proved to him with mathematical certainty that physical defeat would attend all his efforts, would still go on fighting. He would do so, inflicting as much punishment as possible on the enemy, and with a warrior's song in his heart, because it is his nature to do so, and because a victory of the spirit is always won thereby. But having ruled out surrender, what else? In the new convulsive decade of the 1980s, is National Socialism to become at best the minute, defiant echo of a bygone age, a barren exercise in nostalgia, or at worst, the puerile mummery of morons and misfits? Or is it to be subjected to cosmetic surgery, which National Socialism amounts to castration in order to fit the times? Or is there a way in which it can both respond to circumstances with hope of success and yet retain its integrity? Now, on the threshold of a new decade, is high time for some careful and comprehensive stocktaking, which must begin with a sharp scrutiny and a complete survey of our ideology. A creed is not, while it thrives, a static conception, but something lifelike, growing in the minds of its upholders. Absolute fixity comes only with what amounts to death and mummification. The measure of its historical stature, its relevance, and consequent longevity, lies in its fusion of the timeless and the timeful, or the extent to which it combines a permanent constancy of basic principle with a supple adaptability of form and method to time and place, along with a capacity to grow by the development of its potentialities. Where adaptability encroaches on basic principle itself, modifying this in the pursuit of expediency, the trespass creates its own penalty in the fatal illusion of quicker and easier success, for the creed itself fails and disappears through dismemberment. Therein lies the blindness and folly of compromise. On the other hand, where inviolability, which belongs to basic principle, is attached to form and method, and where even that change which is pure progression or germination is denied, then the result is no less disastrous. The creed atrophies and becomes a sterile husk because of this particular confusion of the timeful and the timeless. Therein lies the blindness and folly of rigidity. There is the further complication that ways and means, however optional and variable otherwise, must be consistent with basic principles and thus ultimate objectives. That the end justify the means is a facile assertion, much misunderstood and misapplied in the absence of its corollary, which is that those means must, ipso facto, be in harmony with those ends, which can logically be nothing other than the fulfillment of the basic principles in order to receive the justification thereby. In fact, the ends prescribe the means, and the means determine the actual results. That is the precise interaction. To repeat an old but worthy analogy, you cannot combat cannibalism by consuming cannibals. One cannot promote National Socialism by departing from it, either in the sense of discarding or postponing vital aspects of it, as distinct from truly transitory details of time and place, or resorting to methods which are at variance with basic principles. Those who attempt to do so, on the pretext of increasing popularity and quickening victory, and with the assurance that, thereafter, the real thing will follow, fail to comprehend two facts. Firstly, they fail to perceive the addictive consequences of compromise, according to which power gained by means of compromise is so likely to be used to retain power by means of compromise. Secondly, they fail to perceive that the ultimate end or true purpose of National Socialism is not merely a revolution in the state, but a revolution in the minds of men and women. This must begin before and continue after the attainment of authority in the state, and will necessarily be thwarted by any disabling compromise in the course of attaining that authority. In short, power must be gained through National Socialism in order to be sure of the power to implement National Socialism. Otherwise, the great and bitter irony of the exercise is that the nearer and quicker compromise gets you to power, the further it takes you away from your original ideal and objective. So compromise is indeed a fool's accelerator. National Socialism today, entering the new decade, is endangered fully as much by those within its nominal ranks who incline to try and modify its essential nature by a compromise of principle or the adopting of a conflicting practice, or to confine it to its antecedents, petrifying it in the time capsule of the 30s and the place capsule of Germany. The Jew at the microphone or the communist at the street corner is an enemy readily detected and confronted, but the nominal National Socialist with the weakening words of expediency or the fossilized antiquarian outlook is another more insidious and more injurious menace, effectively an enemy within, albeit unconsciously and unintentionally so. There are those, on the other hand, who seek to reduce National Socialism to something of the so-called right, stifling its supranational and pan-Aryan implications to present it as nothing more than a militant form of the old nationalism, suppressing its radical economic and social implications to make it an accomplice of capitalism, thus depriving it of its revolutionary content in order to accommodate it within the old order which it exists to overthrow and replace. Alongside them are some who want instead to pervert it into something of the left of the old order by distorting its concern for thorough social justice and economic equity to deny that beneficial extent of private enterprise, that justifiable amount of private property, and that essential degree of personal responsibility for one's own welfare, which is equally its concern, thus reducing it to a form of national Bolshevism. In the same business of seeking in one way or another to make our creed acceptable to the old order and thus to render the remedy harmless to the disease are those slick practitioners of political perversion who seek to make political pop out of National Socialism, thus defiling it to death on the plea that they are giving it new life. In the wanton spirit of feeble confession to feckless fashion, they express the foul and ridiculous heresy that to make progress we have to become like the enemy and copy his abominable ways. They then proceed to pride themselves in their meretricious cleverness in seeking to modernize National Socialism by presenting it as with it, meaning in accordance with the very trends of decadence it exists to eradicate. They even go to the extent of wanting to dress it up, literally, in the slovenly jeans which are today's uniform of democratic degeneracy, to crown it even with the long scruffy hair of the dissipated rabble of ragamuffins comprising the modern generation, and to give it as accompaniment even the infernal noise known as rap, which is the authentic flatulence of multiracialism. This they favour in blind disregard of the fact that smartness of personal appearance is the inevitable expression of that perception of order against chaos as the secret of the universe, which is the pith and kernel of our creed, and that the variations of jungle music are abandonment to chaos in sound as contrary to our creed as anything else. The habits and paraphernalia of abandonment and reversion to the jungle are being deliberately promoted, no less than all the miasmic claptrap of permissiveness and brotherhood which goes with them because of the coarsening and cheapening, spiritually sterilizing and racially dissolvent effect. Those ultimately responsible for this conditioning of the masses are those for whom there is most profit in an indiscriminate society of banal barbarity, a mongrel herd kept occupied with trivialities and oblivious to ugliness inspired by the market cry of the television commercial in its pursuit of electronic happiness as its ethos. These Elysian fields of bovine contentment constitute the ultimate containment for the goyim in the oncoming Hebrew millennium. For National Socialism, in mortal conflict with this world wilderness of the zombies, all higher and thus truly human as distinct from animal happiness, is not to be sought in itself, but is the satisfaction of fulfillment, which is the byproduct of service of something greater than self, and wherein courage is the motive, not the superficial and perverse kindness, which is the ubiquitous poisoned sugar in the deadly diet of democracy. Parallel with the debasing modernists of National Socialism are the equally debasing patrons of the chronic misfits, because judicious violence in the true service of National Socialism is justifiable, as at one with all the other forms of nature, and because we National Socialists are rebels against the present society of multiracial democracy, they misinterpret this to sanction association with all sorts of other rebels against this and any and every other society who, with corresponding misunderstanding, conceive National Socialism to be a haven and a stamping ground for their kind. These dealers in flotsam and jetsam are the sort of people who in Britain today resort to increasing manpower by recruiting the mindless oafs from among skinheads, these tonsured, nihilistic hooligans being against all order, old or new, and for violence's sake, and the pure pleasure of damage and destruction. The argument of the patrons of the vandals and the hooligans is, at its least, the simple admission that they think they can make use of the vandalism and the hooliganism, which is the old error of the means defeating the ends, for in truth, it is the antisocial ones who make use of them. At its most, it is the claim that the antisocial ones are the helpless victims of environment and will be drawn to higher purposes by associating with them. Now, if the latter was not merely wishful thinking, but an actual fact, the experiment could be justified. But then in proportion to its success, such as skinheads would manifestly cease to be skinheads, whereas in the instances contemplated, they remain mainly, basically the same. The problem is always to convert to us, and not in the process of gaining attention and influence to fall into what amounts to conversion to others. In the cases in question, the acceptance of such elements, while they clearly remain such elements as members and conspicuous participants in marches and other public events, indicates the degree of conversion the wrong way, comparable to the psychiatrist who begins to contract the psychosis of his patient. The skinheads have stayed skinheads, while the supposed National Socialists have become that much less of authentic National Socialists. It is not the former who have been uplifted, but the latter who have been downgraded by the experiment. These particular protagonists of popularization, meaning perversion, have committed the cardinal error of thinking that putting National Socialism on the streets means allowing it into the gutter with the garbage. They have depleted it to a crude and negative racial hatred and for superficial, anti-red confrontation in the mode and mood of a mob of football fans for whom National Socialism is an excuse for a punch-up, and the swastika a gimmick for shock and scare, and a talisman for mayhem. A different, but no less dangerous, debasement from within, being an extreme form of that rigidity which fossilizes our creed by failing to cultivate freely and fully the implications of its true principles, while slavishly conforming to details which can and should be alterable, comes from those politically superficial and primarily theatrical and positively juvenile exponents who may be termed Hollywood Nazis. For these exhibitionists, dressing up in the costume of the past, treated as a fetish, and posturing and parading as part of the masquerade, provides the pleasure of pretense, which is all it is, although the performance undoubtedly has the psychotherapeutic effect of serving to ease the feeling of inadequacy in its performers, in a manner akin to the African savage who dons the skin of a lion as a mantle in the sure belief that he will thereby become invested with the strength and courage of the king of the jungle. Akin to these performing political playboys, the fancy dress and regalia freaks with their burlesque show are those who, in their similar bondage to the outward forms of the past, entomb National Socialism in a museum of their minds. Content to confine it to the collection of relics and records, and to participate simply by association with souvenirs, they treat it as a finished phenomenon, only to be contemplated in recollection, whereas National Socialist Germany was not the entire and final happening, but the majestic opening act of a continuous work. The National Socialism of the Germany of Adolf Hitler, as expressed by its prime exponents, was the first systematic articulation of the orientation of society in conscious harmony with the discerned laws of nature, as opposed to the harmful, contrary artificialities of all other schools of thought. Perceiving the constant struggle of nature which is the assertion of existence itself and the process of the selection of the fit and the rejection of the unfit, which is improvement. It saw in the order and pattern and ultimate harmony of the universe the essence of beauty, and sought actively to conform to and promote this in the arrangements of man. Since nature is totality, national socialism could only respond by being a totality of outlook, an attitude to everything, not something limited to the territory of politics and thus a fragment of life. It could not be less than a cosmic philosophy, extending to all parts of life in a coherent structure, the spiritual and the cultural, no less than the economic and political, and in consequence, generating its own scale of values and distinctive code of ethics. Thus distinguishing itself by casting man as the fulfilling agent instead of the foe of nature, in an entelechy sought and expressed by living life to the full, National Socialism accordingly dedicated itself to the primary role of race in human affairs, parallel to the role of comparable differentiations in all other living things. It recognized in the human differentiations, both between and within the races, the working of the great test of nature, which is life itself, and through which suitability and superiority are established, and thus the ascent of man on the ladder of creation takes place. In doing so, it observed the paramount civilizing potential of the Aryan, the obstructive and destructive capacity of the Jew, the decline, which is the result of the mixture of the races and the great need for and benefit of eugenical action within the race. Applying this same insight, appreciative of the stimulus and the benefit of competition, to the economic sphere, it upheld private enterprise and private property, personal responsibility, which is inseparable from competition and is the acknowledgement of true freedom and the beginning of leadership in self-leadership and leadership itself as the duty and privilege of superiority. At the same time, the same racial awareness which prompted all this, prompted also, and no less, a concern from kinship which enjoined the reconciliation of competition with cooperation and social justice. This called for measures to allow a fair start and free play to human worth to sustain competition by the prevention of abuses, including its suppression by monopoly, to ensure a fair reward to all, by the prevention of excessive gain to any, to ensure an adequate living in retirement after a useful working life, to confine money to the service of production and consumption, to encourage the health and strength of the people and their native culture, and to preserve all the natural resources and amenities of this world. This may be said to be the bedrock of belief, the basis of the principle of the creed of National Socialism. Anything less than or different from this makes something other than National Socialism.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.